The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Thursday, November 3rd, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's a Cubs world, folks. No two ways about it.
At last.
A little bouncer slowly toward Bryant. He will glove it and throw to Rizzo. It's in time. And the Chicago Cubs win the World Series.
The curse is over after 108 years. Game 7 of the World Series. Cubs over Cleveland 8-7. It went 10 innings. There was a rain delay. This game and series had everything. That was Pat Hughes making the call on WSCR in Chicago. The curse has ended, but away from sports, the high-stakes tactics of electoral politics are colliding with the sacred rights of voters to get to the polls in the culmination of this rowdy, unprecedented 2016 presidential campaign. Listen to this.
You've got to go out, and you've got to get your friends, and you've got to get everybody you know, and you got to watch your polling booths, because I hear too many stories about Pennsylvania, certain areas. I hear too many bad stories, and we can't lose an election because of you know what I'm talking about.
So if you take that statement from Donald Trump speaking to supporters in Pennsylvania last month seriously, and he's been making that statement to supporters around the country, maybe you and some of your friends should get a group together and monitor your polling station to watch for bad stories. Huh? Bad idea. There are strict limits to amateur voter vigilance, and the penalties for overreaching into the realm of intimidation are severe. The Democratic and Republican parties have filed half a dozen complaints about poll monitoring. A group calling itself Stop the Steal, affiliated with Roger Stone, has already attracted attention. State Democratic parties in Arizona, Ohio, Nevada, and Pennsylvania are suing the Trump camp for what they describe as encouraging unlawful voter intimidation. In New Jersey, a federal judge has ordered the Republican National Committee to turn over all communications with the Trump campaign that might tie it to, quote, ballot security. Election officials in Ohio and Nevada have also reported instances of harassment of people voting early. In North Carolina, the NAACP filed a lawsuit that alleges the state is purging black voters from county rolls. And on Tuesday night, the Hopewell Baptist Church in Greenville, Mississippi, was vandalized and set on fire with the words "Vote Trump" spray-painted on an exterior wall. Authorities there are treating the act as one of voter intimidation that amounts to a hate crime. Leah Wright Rigor is the author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. She's also assistant professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government.
We haven't seen this kind of this level, I think, of talk around, you know, keeping a careful eye on the polls and voter fraud in a very long time. Now, the interesting thing here is a lot of it is speculative. A lot of it is kind of neither here nor there. It's very vague. You know, we've seen Donald Trump and campaign surrogates talk about policing the polls, particularly in urban areas like Philadelphia, St. Louis, Chicago, and kind of, you know, suggest this idea that the Clinton camp is going to deploy people to steal this election. Now, what they've said in interactions, subsequent interactions, is that they're not encouraging people. They're not saying go out, but they actually are saying, telling their audience that they need to be very careful and watch. And this is being interpreted in a way that suggests that there are only certain kinds of people that are valid voters, and that anybody who falls outside of this, you know, notion of a valid voter, in this case, a Trump supporter, is somebody that should be challenged. And that it's the right of everyday people to challenge them.
So this federal judge that has ordered the RNC to turn over all communications with the Trump campaign that might be related to something they call, quote, ballot security. What's that judge looking for? What kinds of statements that would be telltale statements on the issues that you're suggesting in that data?
So I think they're probably looking for kind of inflammatory statements, but they're looking for explicit statements that encourage voter intimidation and voter suppression. And so part of this stems from this decree from the 1980s that says that the Republican Party has to, has to be very careful on this issue of poll watching and poll security, that they can't just go up and intimidate or accuse people, that they have to any kind of election day activities or things related to the election actually have to be run through a judge. And it's set to expire in the next couple of years. What's interesting here, though, is that this is the first modern election where we haven't had the protections of the Voting Rights Act. So we've seen the increase in the number of state legislatures that are passing bills, that are passing acts explicitly designed to curb turnout from certain groups of people. In particular, we've seen the one in North Carolina that's undergoing some explosive investigations that explicitly targeted Black voters with, I think the judge's language was, with surgical precision. So in some cases, you're looking for a smoking gun. And so I think a judge is going to be going through that and looking very carefully to ensure that actually what you're not doing is cultivating voter intimidation and voter suppression.
How does social media enable this intimidation tactic? In other words, send messages across state lines or across the country with pictures from places or sending an intimidating message that comes through the screen.
So social media is an interesting space because it's, on the one hand, it's a democratizing space, right? So everyone has a voice, everyone has a platform. And there are really interesting ways in which we're starting to see people mobilize around issues like educational pushes on voter registration, know your rights. It's also been a space where, we've really seen, particularly in the last year, a cohesion around this kind of everyday citizen patrolling and everyday surveillance of people who are not the right kind of people voting, right? There's an image going around that is of a Black woman with, in the back, it says African Americans for Hillary Clinton. And it says, hey, voters, you can text your vote through your phone, just text Hillary. That's not true, but that's also another form of intimidation and suppression. And in this particular case, it is explicitly geared at depressing the turnout of voters of color, particularly Black voters. And so we are seeing these kinds of things spread around. They're shared thousands of times. And this is the kind of thing that I think makes it incredibly difficult to tease out what are your rights at the polls? What are the actual proper ways to vote? It's a pretty disturbing trend.
Leah Wright Regura is author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power, and assistant professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Asked about these legal challenges, charges, and complaints, the Trump campaign gave us this statement. The complaints are long on rhetoric, short on substance, and are clearly designed to change the subject away from Hillary Clinton's mounting legal problems. Stop the Steal and Roger Stone are not affiliated with the campaign, and we have no idea what they are doing. The campaign is doing everything in accordance with applicable law. The suit does not challenge this and asks only that the law be followed, which the campaign is already doing, end quote. So what's it like in the political caves where statements like that are generated, inside the 21st century war rooms of a presidential campaign? About the only sign that you're standing on a street corner in Brooklyn, New York, that marks the Hillary Clinton for President headquarters is the indecipherable sign of a protester who looks a little bit like Michael Moore and a few paparazzi trying to nab a shot of the beleaguered Clinton aide Huma Abedin, unhappily in the news right now. But go upstairs and the ringing phones tell you this is a nerve center.
The headquarters is two different floors. We are on the 11th floor right now, and there's also a lower level. But this floor kind of encompasses IT, analytics, our legal compliance. So everybody up here on this level it's a little quieter. The design team, everybody's like hard at work behind a screen.
Early voting has started, and the lease on the two floors of 1 Pierpont Plaza signed back in April 2015 has only a few more days to go. More than 500 campaign workers are here. They're young, mostly in their 20s, in open spaces, laptops everywhere, colorful Hillary graphics. There's not a hint of Trump Tower glitter. Anyway, our many requests to go backstage at Trump Tower have so far gone unanswered. You don't see any gold here.
Gold? No, there's no 9-foot portraits either. Imagine that.
That's our tour guide, Amanda Finney, a digital correspondence assistant for the campaign.
You know, I think that we're really embodying the whole grassroots campaigning. We're trying to spice it up and be like Google on a good day with the beanbags and, you know, all of the colors. We're trying to be fun. And I think there's a lot of energy and young people here at headquarters. And I think that you see that when you walk around.
Amanda's being shadowed as she gives us a tour by a silent minder from the all-powerful Clinton communications team, making sure we don't wander. Or talk to the wrong person, like the young lawyers in the legal compliance office we say hello to.
No.
Just unfortunately, we didn't get approval from everyone ahead of time, okay. So...
Amanda, she says, is all about message, reaching every voter she can reach between now and November 8th.
You know, if you're on the phone talking to a single mom who's a veteran in North Carolina, like, how can we portray her message to someone in California, to someone in Arizona? Like, why does this mom in North Carolina matter to moms across the country? I think that taking those single people, single individuals, and making it a national story, and how HRC, how Secretary Clinton is going to, like, shape all of those lives, I think that's the power behind HQ.
We showed up on Tuesday, a week out from Election Day, but nobody calls it that here.
Obviously, with 7 days left until E-Day, people have been going to battleground states to knock on doors and do some canvassing and making phone calls and having that like one-on-one interaction with voters, because it's go time, you know, crunch time. So
this place could be empty on election night.
Very well could be. Very well could be. I think we're going to try and have lots of hotline lawyers here to be handling any like voting incidents, but most of staff might be, it's unclear, but a lot of staff could be hitting the pavement on E-Day.
On the 10th floor, you're closer to the center of power. For instance, Clinton veteran John Podesta in a hoodie can be seen consulting a computer screen. There's Huma Abedin herself, hard at work across the room, but she gets a little farther away when she sees our microphones. It's the communications team who dictate every movement of HRC, and they roam these halls in their sweatshirt uniforms. Playful tension, you could call it.
These are the sweatshirts, guys, I was talking about. Can I just hold up one?
Yeah, of course.
So everybody has their little, like, witty, thank you. So policy's right here. The policy team wonks for the win. We have speech writing in the back. We have the best words is kind of their, like, tagline. Surrogates, turning squad goals into squad realities. Here's our communications team. There's tagline is sources close to the campaign.
The food source closest to the campaign appears to be pizza.
That's 12 pizza boxes, Amanda.
I outdid myself, you know? We had a pizza party yesterday.
Pizza to feed all the hungry interns who are crowded at tables not far from oversized futons that look as though they could accommodate a small university.
My department specifically has 14 part-time and full-time interns. Hi, guys.
Hi.
They're working and eating, you know? Multitasking.
Raise your hand if you slept here overnight.
Not yet.
It's coming soon.
There's work. That's all there is. There's work for 7 more days.
That's Adisu Demisi, National Voter Outreach and Mobilization Director for the Clinton campaign. He sounds young, but he's really a veteran. What's it like to be in the bottom of the ninth in a tight race in the World Series of politics?
Campaigns are a bunker mentality. I've been here for 15 years somehow, doing campaigns, and this is one of the best environments I've been in. There have been some downs, no doubt about it, but there's going to be a big up coming here on November 8th.
Some honest, tough campaign tech talk. The young men and women monitoring the pulse of a nation about to decide the most important election of their lives. On the 10th floor of a distinctly unglitzy-looking tower in Brooklyn, New York, you're listening to the hum of a 21st century political machine. We get a special tour of a place where voter numbers and demographics become marching orders, questions about turnout become voter surveys, opposition commercials and their nasty accusations send all the fact checkers into action, and news headlines become policy statements. Welcome to Hillary for President HQ.
My name is Maya Harris, Senior Policy Advisor, Hillary for America. I will say it has gone to a slower pace than at the earlier part of the campaign, but we are still now and again releasing new policy. And, you know, for example, one of the policy issues that we ended up just releasing a policy agenda on was around mental health. When she started the campaign, and in Iowa and New Hampshire, and she heard a lot from people around the country about families that were struggling with, you know, mental health and with addiction. So as a result of that, we ended up actually diving in, and she wanted to make those priority issues for her campaign. They're issues that don't necessarily always make it to the top of the, you know, policy agenda in a presidential campaign, but they are ones that she thought was important.
No one can doubt the importance of data analytics in this 24/7 fact factory.
Ilan Kriegel, Chief Analytics Officer.
For Ilan Kriegel and his team of 60, this election has actually been over with 400,000 times. That's the number of simulations he's been running, testing policy, weather scenarios, anything to know how to move the right voter at the right time in the key zip code.
Once we have that information, we put it out there, and then people are kind of, it's a thought process. You know, what can we do? Is there a technology that we can build that will communicate better that message? So, for instance, we've done a lot of really neat things with our online tools and new tech tools that have just never existed in politics, maybe never existed, period, before. And then from there, okay, well, we have this piece of information, and we're about to give a speech. How do we make sure that whoever that surrogate is giving the speech incorporates that piece of information? Or we're about to run an advertisement on TV. How do we make sure that that advertisement first incorporates that, but also is being delivered to the people who are most interested in whatever that message is? And I think what's really important about what data plays, the role that at least my team plays in this, is, you know, what used to happen in politics is you had a TV kind of an audience, you had an organizing, a field audience who you talked to, you had an audience that you might mail to, and so forth. But now, because we were able to kind of bring everything together, so every kind of the left hand knows exactly what the right hand's doing, and they're working in concert.
Ilan Kriegel's fancy futuristic code very quickly becomes other workers' old-fashioned to-do lists.
My name's Adisu Demesi. I'm the National Voter Outreach and Mobilization Director. My job is essentially to turn data into action in the states, and specifically turnout, mobilization of voters. So the kind of data that he'll give me is how we're doing in a given market, or what demographic that we are overperforming or underperforming with, or what it might be. And so it's my job to take that data and then decide what to do with it. The non-data component is kind of what I focus on, which is, what are our political allies telling us? What are our volunteers telling us that they're hearing at the doors? And we kind of give that qualitative information back to sync up with the quantitative information.
So you know zip codes.
I definitely know some zip codes. If somebody, gun to my head, I could probably name all 99 counties in Iowa if somebody asked.
Would you say that your opponent's outreach is robust, different? How do you run into it?
Not a lot, to be honest. He definitely has not, and the Republican Party definitely has not invested in real grassroots organizing in the way that our party and our campaign have, not just in this campaign, but for this whole century of campaigns. It is very much core to our strategy, not just because it's how we think we're going to win, but it's how you do politics, right? Neighbor to neighbor, person to person.
Strong sense of team here in this
building. Oh, yeah. Not just in this building, but in the states too. Campaigns are a bunker mentality. I've been here for 15 years somehow doing campaigns, and this is one of the best environments I've been in, because we stick together and know that there have been some downs, no doubt about it, but there's going to be a big up coming here on November 8th.
There may be just a wink and a nod or a high five or a fist bump, but how do you folks express solidarity with Huma this week, who's having a difficult time?
Look, Huma is a critical part of our organization. We love her. And she's working, right? Like, we have a job to do. And so all of us, we're not going to get distracted. And that starts with Hillary Clinton. That certainly goes with Huma, her right hand, goes to all of us here. Working is the way we do it. We work to make people's lives better and win the election on November 8th.
So there's no pray for Huma groups around here.
There's work. That's all there is.
Five more days of living what's at stake, keeping the reality of what is happening here from getting in the way of a smiling, joyful scene of democracy in action. But make no mistake, this is war. This is history. This is the biggest event in many of these young people's lives.
OC Imyok Paria, and I am the Chief Product Officer.
Product Officer, what does
yes.
that mean?
So I manage the product managers and the product designers. We are a sub-team of the tech team here on the campaign. And so I'm the lead of sort of our product strategy, our product approach, and the kind of portfolio items that we want to sort of take on behalf of the campaign in terms of tech tools.
And when you say tech tools,
yes.
What kinds of apps are you talking about?
Oh, huge number. So I think that's one of the things that's compelling about this job is the portfolio of technology solutions that we're looking at and that we explore is quite vast. It's everything from back-end systems for data analysis, measurement, and capture, all the way through our website and our blog. So everything in between there, whether it's tools for voters and supporters to learn about her stance on issues, whether it's applications that help our organizers be more efficient and effective, whether it's solutions to help our lawyers protect the vote, the entire gamut of that is the remit of the technology team here on the campaign, and we partner with digital and analytics to make sure that we're delivering great solutions.
It sounds like you have a dream job.
I do.
At a sort of dream moment.
I do.
In the middle of a campaign that's been tremendously emotional and, you know, anxiety-producing for lots and lots of Americans. Mm-hmm. Being a part of a campaign, whether it's now or 50 years ago, involves a real serious emotional commitment.
Mm-hmm.
If Donald Trump is the victor, how devastating will that be for you?
Fairly. As you can see, I'm a woman of color. I also am a recent naturalized citizen of the United States. So on all sort of dimensions, this campaign is very personal. Just kidding.
I can see.
So to work on behalf of the secretary, you know, it's not a joke. It's not a game. It's not a fire drill. This is real. And it impacts people in my communities in a very real way. So, you know, we are a team of people in this building, and I think especially in the States, who are putting it out there every day to try to make sure that the candidate that has real vision for America is the one that's going to succeed. It's not a game.
You going to win?
We are. We are going to win. Absolutely. I think that beyond having the most sort of qualified candidate, we have a team who is intent on making sure that Americans understand the stakes and understand how their vote actually is important. And, you know, in light of sort of, you know, historic levels of voter suppression, we are putting systems and teams in place to make sure that people can have their voices heard.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our tour this week of Hillary Clinton for President National Headquarters in Brooklyn was produced by Oliver Lazarus and recorded by Cambra Moniz Edwards.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
How much will the U.S. election rock the world? In the run-up to Election Day, we visited our neighbors to the north and south and our friends in the U.K. Today, it's more complicated in the Middle East, where the U.S. has long held an outside influence, for better or worse, and where opinions about it differ greatly. Our guide is Borzu Dargahi. He's Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News.
Right now, across the region, there is this, you know, big rift. It's been in place for decades, really, but it has become more pronounced and more of a shooting war in some instances. And so you have these countries and governments and political parties who are more, let's say, part of the pro-Western bloc. These guys obviously have more of a sort of support for Hillary Clinton. They see her as more in line with the kind of U.S. foreign policy that has supported countries like Saudi Arabia, Egypt in the past, has been engaged in the region in a way that they like, been confronting the other forces in the region that are, let's call them what they call themselves, the sort of axis of resistance. Resistance to what? To U.S. and Israeli hegemony. That's how they phrase it. And those countries, loosely allied with Russia, also some political parties and so on, Iran especially, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Syrian government, those people who are, let's say, you know, pro-resistance bloc, they're a little bit more sympathetic to Trump. Now, there's a twist to that because everyone sort of recognizes Trump's blatant Islamophobia and his comments about Muslims and terrorism and so on are seen as very extreme. And people don't like that. And that is sort of confusing the issue a little bit. But generally, that's how the region views the two candidates.
But doesn't the resistance bloc prefer Trump partly because it helps make their argument that the U.S. is actually, I mean, this is the real face of the U.S., Donald Trump, and his election would help them to consolidate their argument against U.S. presence in the region?
Well, I think that might be part of it, but I think it has more to do with Trump's position of why are we involved in this part of the world in the first place? Trump's coziness with Russia, who is sort of viewed as a patron of the resistance bloc. And they also, you know, in the same way that many analysts say Putin prefers Trump just because he would be such a disruptive force, disruptive to the West, disruptive to NATO and so on. They probably prefer him because of that. I should say one interesting thing. In Iran, the sort of capital of the resistance bloc, they actually, it was extraordinary, actually. They broadcast the last debate between Trump and Clinton
wow.
live with simultaneous translation.
Wow.
And they wanted the Iranians to see for themselves U.S. democracy at what many would consider its lowest. You know, the sort of insults, the kind of locker room talk, the references to female anatomy and so on. And then you had, you know, top Iranian officials, including the president, Hassan Rouhani, getting on television and in other interviews and other forums, sort of mocking the U.S. democratic process, saying, I couldn't believe how rude they were to each other. I couldn't believe the insults and so on. Is this the democracy that they want to impose on us?
Do countries care about the fact that the international trade is being bashed around on both sides by both candidates?
You know, in this part of the world, most of the trade is not with the U.S. The EU is the strongest trading partner to Turkey, North Africa, and the Middle East in general. So I don't think there's a lot of worry about that. But there is, I think, a worry perhaps with some countries about U.S. aid and whether under a Trump administration there would be U.S. aid. So those countries such as Jordan and Egypt and Morocco, Afghanistan, Iraq, who get quite a bit of support from the U.S. in terms of military and other types of assistance, I'm sure there's a lot of concern there about a Trump presidency.
It's not well known in the United States that broadly across the Middle East, there's not a lot of satisfaction with the way Barack Obama has run his foreign policy in the Middle East. And I think on both arguments, Trump or Clinton, there is an appetite for change in the region. How does that play out?
Well, I think it's been really instructive, I have to say, over the last 8 years, because you have had finally a U.S. president who has wanted to be less militarily engaged in the region, not try to be so much of a hegemon in the region. And the people complained and the people said, where's the U.S.? You know, people might not remember that 8 years ago, everyone was saying, you know, Yankee out of the Middle East. And now they're saying, oh, Obama left the Middle East and left a vacuum. And this is one of the problems that we're facing now is all these, you know, local and regional powers trying to fill that vacuum.
Is there any country in the region that's in a position, if there's a Trump victory, to be Donald Trump's best friend in that they didn't hedge their bets at all? They stuck with the Trump candidacy and the idea of the Trump candidacy from the beginning?
You know, definitely the government of Abdel Fattah Sisi in Egypt. They are, not only is Sisi a kind of strongman character in the way that Trump seems to fashion himself, but he's, you know, very much welcomed Trump. And Trump himself has said kind things about Sisi. I think there's a lot of affection there. Trump is against Muslim fundamentalists and speaks about Muslim radicals. And Sisi, too, sort of fashions himself as someone who's combating Islamic radicalism and so on. So I think that that is one relationship that will strengthen in case of a President Trump.
Borzu Dargahi is Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News. Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
We are going to focus on many of the issues that voters tell us are most important. Jobs.
Law and order.
Climate change.
Social security.
This next question comes from the public.
The biggest tax cuts.
Your schools are no good.
Immigration. How can you unite a country?
Income inequality.
You have no job.
Gross national debt.
Pre-existing conditions.
Race.
You're living in poverty.
Uncertain issues.
Too much inequality.
Cyber attack.
Deportation.
The Supreme Court.
Discipline.
Let me repeat the question.
Woo! Okay.
So, let's begin.
It's a challenge every election cycle. How do you slice up the American electorate into groups that have meaning if you look at specific issues? Is there a way to really see how issues affect Americans in different communities? Answering this question is the mission of the American Communities Project that has divided the country into 15 distinct communities. Using these categories as a guide and a little of our own reporting, we've been pursuing an initiative we're calling Portrait of an American Voter. We're hearing your thoughts and concerns about the challenges facing our nation. It's not a scientific poll. It's more a personal, emotional exploration of how individual voters are making up their minds on issues from education and the environment to police brutality and PTSD. Up next, we hear from a voter in the evangelical hub community type.
My name is Rit Verriel. I'm from Shelby, North Carolina, 45 years of age, and I've been in the ministry for 20 years, and prior to that, I was in the military. You know, Shelby sits on what used to be called the King's Highway that went from Charlotte up toward the mountains. But if you get off of the bypass and you actually go through downtown Shelby, you see a very, you know, quaint community that Shelby has done a great job and continues to work aggressively on an uptown, you know, revitalization. Here at Elizabeth Baptist, we have a really good blend of young people. The fastest growing demographic in our congregation is actually married 20-somethings. So we've got a great group of young people, very strong children's ministry, but we also have a very vibrant senior adult ministry. From the more local level, and even fine-tuning it to the congregation of Elizabeth Baptist, we can attribute the increase in young people coming to the church and really being involved and interested in what's going on. There's no doubt it's attributed to kind of that encroachment on religious liberty that we're seeing in the larger culture. And I think what's driving that in conversation with them, what I'm hearing is, what kind of world will my children have? You know, what kind of nation will my children be in? And I think that's the tension that evangelicals are feeling right now. I don't know that evangelicalism has figured this out at this point as to how to really stand up in a very principled manner, in an uncompromising manner, for the things that you know, that we believe in. You know, at what point do you finally stand up and say, no, you know, I'm not going to force my beliefs on you, but neither should you have the right to force your beliefs on me.
To hear all 15 voices featured in our Portrait of an American Voter project, head over to thetakeaway.org/voter. The TCS New York City Marathon, annual ritual here in New York, will be run on Sunday, which will mean some voters will still be sore by Tuesday, first-time marathoners especially. Will Reeve, ESPN sports reporter and son of the late Superman actor Christopher Reeve, who was paralyzed in 1995, is one of those first-timers. In a group of 50 people dubbed Team Reeve to raise thousands of dollars for the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation. The foundation is dedicated to funding research and support for those living with paralysis.
I've always been a huge supporter of Team Reeve, and I'm a board member on the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, and I am an ambassador for the foundation, so I work closely with everyone in the spinal cord injury community. And I'd always said, maybe next year, because I'm not a runner. It just wasn't something I foresaw myself doing. And then finally, not only did I run out of excuses, but I also realized that there's no place for excuses around the Reeve Foundation, because the work we're trying to do is too important. And the people who we're doing the work for, they don't make excuses ever. And they would do anything to even be able to step up to the starting line of a marathon. So I said, you know what, let's just do it. And before I could second guess myself, I signed up and then went for a run, and I was off.
Is this for the cure? Is this for a lot of different things that the foundation does?
Well, the Reeve Foundation's mission is twofold. We are committed to both enhancing the quality of life of those affected by paralysis, not just the injured, but their loved ones and their extended networks were able to live as fulfilling and as enriched a life as possible. So that's one mission of the Reeve Foundation. And the other is what my dad was more focused on, which was the pursuit of a cure. So we continue to be very aggressive in our funding of research of all kinds.
You know, your dad went into his injury, as a lot of us do, hoping for a miracle, hoping for something to change, and determined, as he was very, very determined to, you know, to walk again. But, you know, sadly, after his death, doctors, you know, came to the conclusion that among the greatest contributions that he made was to make doctors forever after understand the value of maintaining circulation in lower extremities, as he always did, anticipating that someday he might run a marathon. And that is, even if nothing changes, that is an extraordinary legacy to the standard of care for people with spinal cord injuries. And it's clear that he's already extended the lives of millions of people. Are you aware of that?
I must say I am aware of that, because I lived that with my dad. The relentless determination he had to be as prepared as possible to be patient zero for a cure. Whatever treatment, whatever procedure could be done, he wanted to be on the bleeding edge of. He was there for all of it. He was constantly pushing, striving, putting pressure on scientists and doctors and advocacy groups to keep pushing for a cure. And that was what the public saw. But I also saw every day he would get out of bed and spend his entire day rehabbing, exercising. We'd have nurses and aides at the house moving his limbs with their hands. Just, he had all these machines. We had an entire room of our house filled with machines that were specific to helping people with spinal cord injuries try to regain movement one day. And to me, the legacy I see is sweat rolling down his forehead and him getting to work, because he knew that that was the only way he was going to be able to walk again. And it was something that has stayed with me since, in terms of work ethic and pursuit of my goals.
Good luck.
Thank you very much. I'm going to need it.
Will Reeve, sports reporter for ESPN, son of actor Christopher Reeve, running the New York City Marathon, the TCS New York City Marathon. So back to politics, and let's take a look at Missouri. Donald Trump is holding up a sizable lead in the Show Me State, but the Senate race is too close to call. Republican incumbent Roy Blunt is running for re-election, a former six-term congressman. His challenger, though, Democrat Jason Kander, is an Army veteran currently serving as Missouri's Secretary of State. Joe Manis is political reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Joe, welcome to The Takeaway.
Well, thanks for having me.
So what is this curious anomaly? Trump's way ahead, but the Senate race is neck and neck.
Well, actually, for Missouri, it's not such an anomaly. You just have to look at 2012, where Mitt Romney won the state by almost 10 points. But Claire McCaskill, who's a Democrat, won re-election for the U.S. Senate by almost 15. So that's like a 25% swing just between the two top things in the ballot. It's not unusual, even though Missouri the last decade has generally trended towards the Republican for president. Democrats hold most of our statewide offices. And so it's not unusual to see this. It may look odd from the outside, but this is Missouri. So.
What is, yeah, right. Show me. Exactly. What is Trump's appeal, and why doesn't it bleed into Blunt's campaign?
Well, and it might bleed into Blunt's campaign. I want to preface that pretty quickly. I think Trump's appeal here is the same appeal that he has everywhere else. He's considered an outsider. You've got a frustrated working class, whites especially, who've seen a lot of their jobs go overseas the last 30 years. And so they're very receptive to his comments about trade. And they're looking for somebody different, fresh face, even though he's 70. So it kind of fits into that. And actually, that's one of the things about Kander. Kander's in his mid-30s. He's considered a fresh face. And in some ways, what he's doing, he's sort of globbing on to this whole anti-establishment movement. And in fact, most of the ads that he's running and the national Democratic groups that are here running ads on TV, they're basically hitting Blunt as being part of the establishment, fair or unfair. That's sort of their the thing they're focusing on, the fact that his wife and his adult children are all lobbyists. They're pointing to his house that he lives in Washington. So it's that sort of thing. So basically, Kander's taking the same, I'm the outsider, I'm the fresh face. I'm the new person you could send to Washington. So that's sort of his pitch. And in some ways, that might not work. But as you know, he is a military veteran. He kind of stunned a lot of people with his ad a few weeks ago where it shows him assembling an assault weapon blindfolded while he's explaining why he favors gun rights but does support background checks. And that sort of nullified Blunt's support by the NRA.
And, you know, tell me about that. Was that his idea? I mean, was that all his idea, or was that some, you know, campaign strategist?
No, they were talking, but no, it was not a campaign strategist. I've talked to him and his staff about it, and you know, he's been running for over a year, so most of the guys who are with him and women are all local, and so they're just hanging around talking, and it sort of came up, and somebody said, oh, could you do that blindfold? I mean, they're just kind of joking around. And goes, well, yeah, of course. You know, because you have to do that in the middle of the night. And he did it on the first take.
Oh, my God.
They did some more takes, but he actually did he did it on the first take.
That is a great story. We're talking with Joe Manis, political reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. So if this is a pickup for the Democrats, there must be lots of outside money here.
Oh, yes, there's huge. Now, initially, a lot of the outside money was for him, and I think that kind of – we're talking the last month. And that sort of helped him because Blunt was considered to have an edge of a few points, and that kind of moved him into a tie. Well, then the Republicans have really come in big in the last week and a half. So right now the spending is probably 2-1 Republican as far as outside groups. The Federal Election Commission, I was looking at their site recently – and they're estimating that maybe close to $40 million in outside money has been pouring in the Senate race, not just on ads, but on other stuff. So it's very tense. Now, the issue is going to be whether or not Kander can withstand the onslaught. A couple of the Republican ads show his face morphing into Hillary Clinton's. So it's going to be very – people are paying very close attention to this. But right now, the polls show it tied.
Joe Manis, political reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Great stuff. Thanks so much, Joe.
Well, thank you.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.